become good at what it is you do, and everything will flow from that. People will want to work with you, and it'll create more work, which will make you further excellent. So it's a virtuous cycle. Focus first on what's in front of you and become excellent at that, and then grow from that.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Dwayne Morris DEI 360 with Joe West. I am Yumika Anderson Howard, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Manager at the firm. On today's episode, Dwayne Morris, Executive Compensation and Benefits Partner John Nixon, joins Joe for an interesting conversation on his career path, being a trusted advisor to his clients, and his thoughts on the future of ESG.
Hello, this is Joseph West. I'm a partner at Dwayne Morris and the firm's Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer. Today, I have the privilege of chatting with not only my fellow partner at the firm, fellow member of the Partners Board, which is the managing body of our firm, but fellow Louisianian, John Nixon. John is a partner in our ELBI group. John, welcome, sir.
Thank you, Joe. Good to be here with you. Good to be here with you, man.
So, John, tell us what ELBI is and tell us about your practice and how it fits within that spectrum.
Certainly. So ELBI is the Employment Benefits, Labor and Immigration Group here at Dwayne Morris. And I'm in that second letter, the Benefits Group. So my practice is employee benefits and executive compensation. I work with companies, pension funds, and significantly with individuals in all aspects of employee benefits. With respect to individuals, I do a lot of work on negotiation of executive employment agreements, and I could go into that a little bit in a little bit of detail for you.
Well, let's get to that later on, but let's go back in time and get your background, your history. I know you're a Michigan and a Penn guy. Not too far back in history, but far enough.
Oh, no. I got to go all the way back. All the way back. I am from Abbeville, Louisiana, in Vermilion Parish. So
there we go.
Joe's the city boy. I'm a country boy in Louisiana. But then I went on to Penn and the Wharton School, and then to Michigan Law, and I graduated from Michigan in 88 and began my practice as an ERISA attorney in 88. And it's been 30 plus years now.
John, what's the reason you chose that particular area of specialty?
Well, I by nature am risk averse. So when I was at Michigan Law, I had a professor who was one of the leading benefits practitioners when ERISA and employee benefits was really a new field. And he said, you know, as the population ages, this is going to be a very interesting and growing field to join. And what I didn't know at the time was that it was very much a tax-driven field because ERISA is jointly covered by the labor code, Title 29, and the tax code, Title 26. And so it actually turned me into de facto tax lawyer because I had to learn a lot of tax law, and really the driving force behind the practice was understanding how the tax laws applied in terms of deductibility. And then later, as I got into executive comp, some of the incentives that were created for compensation at the top of the house. So I kind of consider myself a quasi tax lawyer in addition to being a quasi employment lawyer.
So let's talk a little bit about the executive compensation role now, John. You and I both know, and we talk about this a lot, that ESG is an issue that's on the lips of pretty much everybody in corporate leadership now. One aspect of it is wage and income disparities within corporations, the extent to which executives might be making compensation that's disproportionate to others within the company. How has that discussion impacted your practice? And what are some of the things that you take into account now when you're advising executives in this space?
Well, it's funny. I didn't think you were going to go in the ESG direction. So I'm going to answer that question from two perspectives. From the perspective that you asked it with respect to executives, increasingly, the proxy advisory firms, the big proxy advisory firms, ISS, Glass Lewis are looking at compensation arrangements, and they're assigning some value to some of these ESG factors, including advanced policies on diversity and inclusion, including meeting certain benchmarks on environmental markers and so forth. Corporate governance has always been a part of it, but you're starting to see this work its way into sort of the schemes and the regimens of compensation for public company compensation.
Right.
But if I may, I'm going to put on another hat that I wear, which is I represent a lot of governmental pension funds. As I mentioned, I was a tax lawyer by training, and I am currently the president of the National Association of Public Pension Attorneys, which are all the in-house pension councils for all the big pension funds, CalSTRS, Texas Teachers, Pennsylvania Teachers, and so forth. And they're increasingly looking at ESG issues as they begin to sort of create their investment portfolios.
And in some places, under a lot of pressure. Right.
Bingo, Joe. This is an interesting issue because it's a very much, without getting too political, a red and blue issue. Mm-hmm. And you have some states that are very, very interested in ESG, and you have other states that are very anti-ESG.
Right.
So looking at it from both the investment side, there's sort of a regimen that we're trying to watch develop. And looking at it from the compensation side, there's a compliance aspect that we're trying to meet as well.
How has the landscape changed over the last, let's say, 3 to 5 years? And this is even more difficult question, given the sort of, politicization of this issue. What do you see for the next 2, 3, 5 years in this space?
Well, 3, 5 years ago, it was something that was developing. There was a lot of interest in it, certainly a lot of interest on the investor side, maybe a little bit of hesitation on the company side in terms of, is this something we really have to be attuned to? When Larry Fink and BlackRock sort of put down their mandate that this is something they expected to see their portfolio companies pay attention to, you saw a lot of drivers toward this. But in terms of, where we are now, it's interesting that the first veto by President Biden was over an ESG bill. And it was a bill that was written in response to Department of Labor regulations that I've spent time training clients about across the country. So the issue has gotten extremely polarizing. I think, though, that people who view ESG as an integral part of their portfolio will continue to do so. I think there are other states where, there's political capital in being against it. So I think you're really going to see a divide where sort of the red and blue are going to continue to separate on this, but I think it's around to stay.
Well, it's interesting because part of the argument of the red state, governors, legislators, is that it's too woke and that it is unnecessarily risky. Well, all investment carries some measure of risk.
Right.
So the underlying question is, is there a business case to be made for focusing on securities that carry with it some protection of the environment, some respect for workplace and individuals and, protected classes of individuals in the community and good governance practices? It's kind of hard, in my opinion, to make the argument that those things don't carry with it some benefit to the enterprise, to the securities. So, and I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but.
You're preaching to the choir, but I could give you a good hard example. I mean, there a lot of investors are really, really sort of looking at, for example, if you're in fossil fuels, they are investing in fossil fuel companies, but with an eye towards saying, okay, you need to diversify because clearly, you know, there, you know, as things shift, there may be more regulation. So should you, again, within your portfolio, figure out ways to diversify your board, your R&D, to sort of bring in some of these alternative strategies. So I think when people sort of, and look, listen, we're both from Louisiana. You know, I grew up with guys who graduated from high school and went offshore the next day.
That's right.
So I know what oil and gas is about. But in the same vein, there are a lot of companies that are sitting there thinking, well, you know what? Is there a long-term sustainability case? And is there a way we could deal with it and sort of address a way to move forward? So I think you have to take the long view on this.
So John, let's talk a little bit about diversity. Mm-hmm. This is probably not an area where there are a lot of people of color who have the level of expertise that you have. Mm-hmm. I know that you're involved in a number of organizations, ELC being one of them. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about ELC. I know the firm has been very active in supporting your involvement with that organization. Talk about it and talk a little bit about the benefits of being a member of it and being supportive of it.
Absolutely, Joe. And I want to thank you and the firm for your support in that regard. ELC is the Executive Leadership Council, which is basically an organization. It's about 35 years old, and it's made up of senior executives, and by definition, within two levels of the chief executive officer, enterprise chief executive officer, who are African American. And it is unapologetically African American, because when it was started, there were very few in that C-suite or near C-suite proximity. So I'm fortunate to be a member. I'm sort of an aberration, because there are not very many lawyers who are members who are not general counsels, but part of my practice is representing executives as they go in and out of companies. Mm-hmm. And as it happens, that happens to be where a lot of those executives are. They're in the ELC. Right. So it has been beneficial for me in terms of growing my practice. I've been able to meet a number of extraordinarily talented people and help them, for lack of a better term, create wealth. Because the negotiation of a contract is, especially at that level, can really be generationally defining. And if you go into it with a sort of a skill set that understands some of the complexities of compensation at that level, you can do a lot better. So it's been a great fortune, because I get to work with great people. And I get to help them in ways that, you know, sometimes they didn't know they needed the help.
Well, listen, that's critically important. John, having spent the bulk of my career in-house, including 5 years at Fortune One, the role of the general counsel has evolved so much over the last just 10 years, you know, from being, you know, sort of like leading the department of no to becoming a trusted business advisor, a part of the C-suite, actually in the room when the organization is seeking to embark on some new endeavors. As somebody who spends a lot of time engaging with GCs, particularly GCs of color, can you talk a little bit about what you've observed from your perch in engaging with these types of individuals? What are some of the concerns they have? What are some of the things that's on their mind, so that people who are listening can have a better understanding and some insight into their world?
Well, you know, there are a couple of things, Joe. That's a very good question. But, you know, these people are extremely skilled at negotiations, but it is very difficult to negotiate on your behalf.
Yeah.
And while they may come out of a litigation background or a securities background or, a procurement background, when you get to the negotiation of your own contract, it can be overwhelming, because you still have all the other aspects of your day job. You are, you know, negotiating with a new company. There is a recruitment firm involved. And then you have someone sort of hitting you with a fire hose of completely new terms and conditions and stock equity grants and buyout grants and deferred compensation, restricted stock and so forth. And you still have your day job. So you have this day job, you're trying to negotiate you know, perhaps moving up to from a private company to a public company, from a Fortune 1000 to a Fortune 100 company, and you need help. So that's kind of where I come in.
All the personal and family stuff associated with the transition.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, I will say that I oftentimes have those conversations with both my client and my client's spouse or partner, because if, for example, it involves a relocation, you know, how do we handle that relocation if they have a teenage daughter who's a junior in high school?
Yeah,
that's very real.
Real world stuff.
And that's stuff that you have to negotiate. So sometimes it's not merely about the money. It's about the money. It's about the terms and conditions. It's about the relocation. And more importantly than most people will realize, it is about the severance.
Yeah.
And I'm a strong, strong believer in negotiating all the factors up front. You negotiate the money up front, but you have to negotiate the exit up front. When everybody's still happy and everybody's in the, you know, in the love, in the lovey-dovey portion, you
have
to negotiate the downside.
Yeah, because I think the average GC tenure for publicly traded companies is like 4 or 5 years or something like that. It's, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So somebody's going to leave at some point.
Someone's going to leave at some point. And look, and look, listen, you hope the departure is mutual and friendly and amicable, and they're leaving to go to a greater opportunity. But there's no guarantee of that.
Right.
And when, you know, the more money you make, the longer it takes between jobs, and you need to have some protection. So there's all kinds of aspects that are unique to GCs, but that apply to corporate executives in general that I try to help out with. And one point I would make, Joe, with respect to people of color, you know, my dad and my mom were school teachers, so they didn't get stock options.
Right.
So I wasn't going to ask them about stock options, and I wasn't going to ask them about restricted stock. And for a lot of us, we're the first generation in our family to be in this position.
Right.
So it helps to have a trusted advisor that they could ask questions to, that they don't have to feel uncertain or insecure about asking questions, who will talk to them frankly about, okay, this is what you need to know. Mm-hmm. Just because this is what I do. I mean, I do it all day, every day. So, you know, it's comforting to them to know they have someone on their side.
Well said. Last question, John, before we go. I never like to talk to people who are successful without giving them the opportunity to speak to some younger law student or lawyer joining the profession and give them some words of wisdom. What's some advice that you would give to someone joining the profession right around now?
Okay. I think try to become a master of your craft. And if your craft is litigation and it requires you to, you know, have a motion practice, become the best writer you can, seek every resource you can, talk to the best writers you know. But it is crucial for you to become competent and then excellent first, and then move on to some of the ancillary things. I mean, sometimes I see young people, they're so ambitious. They wanna, you know, and my emphasis is always become good at what it is you do, and right, everything will flow from that. People will wanna work with you. People will wanna give you work, and it'll create more work, which will make you further excellent. So it's a virtuous cycle. And you and I have, you know, daughters the same age, and I'm certain it's the same advice you give to your daughter, which is focus first on what's in front of you and become excellent at that, and then grow from that.
No, that's very, very good advice. And you're right, John. John Nixon, thank you for joining me. Thanks for sharing your journey, your skill set, your expertise. We're lucky to have you at Duane Morris, brother.
Thank you, brother. Always good to see you, homeboy.
All right,
take
John.
Take care. Go Tigers.
There you go.
Take care, man.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.